Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing, where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago, where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? They've taken husbands, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? They're all in uniform. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Yes, I'm Dev Pete Seeger, kicking off this week's broadcast of Radio Resistance Chesterfield. Where have all the flowers gone? Sadly, Pete Seeger is no longer with us. He passed away earlier this week, but his music will live forever and will inspire generations to come. Now, this is a week of anniversaries. On Thursday, the 30th of January, it was the anniversary of the execution of Charles the First, but on a rather less positive note, it's also the anniversary of the 1972 Bloody Sunday massacre in Northern Ireland, when peaceful protesters were shot by, murdered by the parachute regiment of the British Army. Also, on the Sunday the 1st of February, it's the anniversary of the civil rights lunch counter sit-in in the US in 1960, which was a important point in the civil rights movement for black people in the US. Anyway, getting back to Bloody Sunday, there's only one way to permanently solve the problem of partition in Northern Ireland and the unrest that's bound to bring, and that's in the immortal words of Paul McCartney and Wings. Give Ireland back to the Irish.
Nobody knows like me what real
Yeah, sound of Paul McCartney and Wings, Give Ireland Back to the Irish. And on the subject of war, I'm going to talk about World War One. Now, there's all of the stuff at the moment trying to not only glorify the First World War, but also, there's apologists for the First World War who've been saying that it wasn't as bad as it's made out to be. Well, sorry, but it was. It was a terrible, unnecessary, imperialist war. It was nothing to do with defence, nothing to do with defending freedom or anything. It was all about imperialism and the carve-up of the world for new markets for capitalists. And it left more than 9 million military dead and 10 to 12 million civilians dead as well. Now, the Socialist Worker this week has a feature on those who quite rightly and quite bravely refused to fight in World War One. Indeed, many felt so strongly that they even refused to accept the status of conscientious objector. Which is especially a brave thing to do, what with all of the propaganda at the time making out that if you didn't fight, you were a coward. I mean, this was the time of your white feathers and what have you. And there was heavy propaganda all around in a lot of ways. I mean, the whole sort of alleged reason for the war was that there were supposedly German atrocities, the supposed raping of Belgian nuns. And this has parallels with 1990 during the war after Iraq invaded Kuwait, when it was alleged that Iraqi soldiers ripped Kuwaiti babies out of incubators in Kuwaiti hospitals. Now, just like with the alleged German soldiers raping of Belgian nuns, that didn't happen either. Now, as well as those who objected to the war and refused to fight, many of whom ended up in jail, there were some other famous people who were jailed for opposing World War One. For example, there was US socialist Eugene Debs, who was still in jail after the war ended in 1920. Indeed, it was in 1920 that he stood for president from his jail cell and got a million votes. And there was the famous German socialist revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, who again was jailed for opposing World War One. Now, among people who opposed World War One was Sylvia Pankhurst, the suffragette, although her mother Emmeline, who was also a suffragette, supported World War One. Now, this people on the radical left opposing supporting World War One has parallels with the Iraq War of 2003, when although the vast majority of people on the left, including many within the Labour Party, especially on the Labour left, there were some who supported it on the so-called decent left, whose figurehead seemed to be Nick Cohen, and whose mouthpiece was the dreadful, what was it called, website, Harry's Place. On the plus side, though, as I say, most people opposed the Iraq War of 2003, and similarly, a lot of people opposed the World War One even at the time. And as well as those who refused to sign up and refused conscription, there were cases during the war itself when the soldiers at the trenches refused to fight. Indeed, there were times when both the British and the soldiers put down their arms and famously had a football match during World War One. And at the end, it was German soldiers mutinying that brought World War One finally to an end. Back though to the times when both the British and German soldiers put down the weapons and refused to fight. This next track is by The Farm, and its track entitled All Together Now, which is about exactly such an occasion.
All together now.
This is Radio Resistance News, brought to you courtesy of Socialist Worker Newspaper. If they get away with these cuts, they'll cut again before the next election. And I'll tell you what, people won't be able to live. Ricky Tomlinson told Socialist Worker. Ricky railed against the social crisis caused by Tory austerity at the same time as they tell us we're better off. There has been a huge increase in people relying on food banks. 500,000 have visited one of 400 run by the Trussell Trust in the last 10 months alone. As Ricky said, the world is rich and we're a rich nation. There should be no such thing as food banks. It's disgraceful, but it's testimony to capitalism. Politicians and businessmen were trying to restore order in Ukraine as Socialist Worker went to press. Protests have spread across the country from the capital, Kiev, as the climb down by Ukraine's rulers fails to satisfy the protesters. But despite the huge scale of the protests, so far the movement remains trapped as a bargaining chip for the interests of the West, Russia and Ukrainian bosses. UCU union members in universities across Britain went on strike this week in a battle for a decent pay rise. University bosses have offered a measly 1% this year on the back of several years of below inflation rises, while some university workers don't even earn the minimum wage. The military regime in Egypt used the third anniversary of the revolution to display its grip on power. As many as 100 people were killed and over 1,000 were arrested. 2 days later, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was cleared to stand in the presidential elections. Also in this week's Socialist Worker, care workers in Glasgow City Council's residential homes went on strike for 48 hours on Monday and Tuesday of this week to resist pay cuts of up to £1,495 a year. Locals and trade unionists in Barton Moss, Greater Manchester, joined forces against fracking. The media panic about a rapid rise in new drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis in London is based more on racism than scientific fact. You can read your copy on Socialist Worker online. www.socialistworker.co.uk. Or you can buy Socialist Worker each Saturday in Chesterfield Town Centre outside Primark between 11 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. I can pick up your copy from the branch meetings on Thursday nights at 7:30. Or to get your copy delivered, phone or text 07919 486101 or email swpchesterfield@tesco.net. Socialist Worker is your paper. Buy it, read it, sell it.
Aap Radio Resistance sun rahe hain.
Going to the pictures, see the late, late show. You're told that you're a fire risk, so the wheelchair has to go. You're in your seat, you turn around, you wave your wheels goodbye. You don't need many guesses who's gonna be the first to fry. But if you try to argue, that's my leg you're taking away. You can guarantee there'll always be somebody there who'll say, got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you. Be a quiet little crip without a chip. Waiting on the platform to board the 905. You travel with the livestock, at least it proves that you're alive. You can make friends with the pigeons there and keep each other warm. There's no heathen in that cage and it's brewing up a storm. No clamps to hold you down, you feel your body slipping away. But if you moan, it's 10 to 1 that God will come and say, you got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you, and be a quiet little crip without a chip. I've never done a marathon, I'd sooner drink and smoke. But what's your opening question? Are you that TV wheelchair bloke? And how'd you get like that then? Was it some great tragedy? I was stuntman in Jaws 2, and I really earned me fee. And I sit here and wonder what you hear and what you see. Are you looking at the chair, or are you listening to me? Got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you. Be a quiet little crip without a chip. Oh yeah, be a quiet little crip without a chip. That's right, be a quiet little crip. Quiet little crip. Quiet little crip without a chip.
Yeah, the sound of Ian Stanton, Chip on Your Shoulder. Now, I mentioned in the news about Ricky Tomlinson and how he's come out against the Tory government cuts and austerity measures, and how they're causing poverty and an alarming number of people needing to resort to using food banks. Now, earlier on this week, we had the rabid outburst from former Tory Minister Edwina Curry, who was ridiculously claiming that food banks were closing down shops. Funny, I always thought that was because people couldn't afford to buy food from shops and because of big supermarkets driving out small shops. But then, anyway... Ricky Tomlinson is the latest of a number of celebrities to come out against the government and the capitalist system. Not so long ago, Russell Brand was urging revolution. But it's true to say that Ricky Tomlinson, who is now an actor best known for his roles in The Royal Family, Cracker and Brookside, does have a long history of left-wing political activity. Years before he became an actor, back in 1972, he was a trade unionist during the first ever National Building Workers' Strike. The strike was a success, and it won a 25% pay rise and better union organisation. But when furious bosses sought revenge, he ended up convicted of conspiracy to intimidate and was sentenced to 2 years in jail. He's still campaigning against his conviction and that of others who were convicted with him. Also in this week's issue of Socialist Worker, he talked about the Shrewsbury 24 campaign against his conviction and those who were convicted with him. From the Socialist Worker, a parliamentary debate last week demanded the release of documents related to that time, and the motion passed by 120-3. The Tories, though, would say the release of the papers and documents must wait another 10 years for reasons of national security. However, Ricky said, "We think they're going to have to release the papers because we've discovered secret documents." "It's gone to the Criminal Case Review Committee now," he said. "I just think that something crazy sinister is going on. We've got letters from Ted Heath stamped confidential. They set up a unit during the strike for agitators and stuff like that." And in his speech from the dock at the time, Shrewsbury picket Des Warren said, "The conspiracy was between the Home Secretary, the employers and the police." 2-2. Anyway, back to the music now. Here's the sound of Steve White and the Protest Family, appropriately enough. Right to Strike.
From the tall paddle bars to Brian and May, from the Liverpool docks to the workers at BA, since the general strike, the workers say, not a penny off the pay, not a second on the day. History tells us to fight. Sometimes you need to stand up for your rights. It's time to break the law. Take on the bastards that change clause for. It's time to break the law. Your right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. They had to break the law. George Lovelace and his mates. Lansbury knew the rules when he refused to pay the rates. It was principle and justice, not the laws of our time, that caused the dockers not to cross the picket line. History tells us we must stand up and be counted when we know that it's just. Time to break the law. Take on the bastards that change clause for. It's time to break the law. Your right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. Margaret Thatcher took our rights away, but in 1997, nothing really changed. We didn't know you, Labour, would choose to ignore the history of the movement, George Bernard Shaw. History will call us fools if we elect her. Take on the bastards that change clause for. It's time to break the law. Your right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. Worth fighting for.
Yeah, sound there. Steve White and the Protest Family, Right to Strike. Well, Thursday just gone, the Socialist Workers' Party in Chesterfield hosted a book launch of the new book by Martin Empson, a environmentalist and socialist. His latest book is called Land and Labour. Now, I'd love to tell you a little bit about it, but since I've only just started reading it, I think I'll let Martin Empson tell you about it himself. Take it away.
Enormous amount of ground. In fact, it covers about 3 million years worth. So I'm not going to speak in great depth about all of it. You'll have to buy it to find the bits I've missed. The enormous environmental crisis that we face, the huge threat from global warming, from climate change, that's playing itself out in numerous different ways around the world at the moment. That stuff is in the book, as is an argument that the solutions to that crisis are relatively straightforward technologically and could be implemented quite quickly, given states desiring to do so. Partly it's in the book because I think it's very important that political activists and campaigners of all sorts educate themselves more about what climate change is, what causes it, you know, how we can organise against it, how it's happened historically, and all that sort of stuff. Because I believe, and one of the central arguments of the book, is that the reason there has been so little action from governments, from politicians, and so on, despite the overwhelming scientific evidence, is that because action on climate change means confronting the way that the priorities of our system, the system we live in, the capitalist system, are organised. And I want to, one of the points of the book really is to say that that is the result of a long period of historical development that humans have been through. The book is an attempt to locate the current environmental crisis, if you like, within human history, in particular within the relationship that humans have always had with the natural world, with nature, and so on. A relationship that's changed over time, that's developed, that's altered, and so on. And so far has arrived at the point of a capitalist system that sees the natural world as merely the source of raw materials for the production process, for the dump, for the waste from that production process, something that is neglected in terms of the dots and commas of the profits. And one of the things I want to say about the book is that in the book I argue at great length that it's not always been like that. The relationship that we as humans have had with the natural world that we are part of has changed dramatically through time. We've had all sorts of different ways of relating to nature, all sorts of different ways of working with it and changing it, but all sorts of different ways as well of perceiving the natural world. Now, humans, right from whatever, a million years ago we start from, have always changed the natural world. They've done so in traumatic and fundamental ways for millions of years. Karl Marx famously said that the first historical act is the production of material life itself. The sense that the very first act of history was humans changing nature in some sense to provide the basic needs for their lives. And he then wrote elsewhere, in fact, that labour is the appropriation of nature for the satisfaction of human needs, that we labour upon nature, we change nature through our work, through the labour process in our interest. But nature isn't simply a recipient of change from humans. It's not something that we've simply altered over time. Nature is also the backdrop to all our human history. In particular, it reflects sometimes and it demonstrates the antagonisms within human society. The unequal nature of human society is often played out through the natural world or parts of the natural world that we occupy. One classic and superb example, and something I'll talk about at length tonight and in the book, is agriculture. Agriculture has always been a scene, from the earliest days of class society, has been a scene of struggle. People have fought for the right to occupy land, to use land, to labour on land. They fought for the right to have the largest proportion of the products of their farming to themselves and not have to give it to a master or a landlord or something like that. That said, nature isn't separate. We are part of nature. We've evolved out of the animal kingdom and we've developed and so on. And that's fundamental, in fact. That interaction with the natural world is fundamental to our history. The earliest evolution was in fact shaped by climate change. You know, the way that the sea levels rose and fall have determined how and where humans at different points in that history were able to live or were able to migrate. And so one of the first chapters does deal with that evolution of humans over the earliest time. But I want to now start really with with one of the other fascinating things I think about the natural world, which is that the natural world, almost everywhere on the globe, is the product of decades, centuries, millennia of human interaction. And there's very little natural world left in one sense, certainly not in the British Isles. We value those moors and those, the Peak District and so on for its, the fact that it's open, windswept and beautiful and so on. A complete artificial landscape that arises out of the fact that, you know, in the Bronze and Iron Ages, our ancestors took down all the trees so they could clear the area for agriculture. Many, many other examples. Just one final one, because it fits the history. There's a mountain in the French Alps that was 20 feet shorter in 1918 than it was in 1914 because of the battleground that was going on, and so much artillery was fired at the mountain, or people entrenched in that mountain, that it reduced its altitude. So even the geology, never mind the plants and the animals, have been changed over years, and we continue to do so. There's Wyoming in the United States, where the local government has said it's okay to frack on an enormous scale. Now, I live in Salford, where they've just started one of these little things, and we're damned they're not going to build any more of the things if me and the local campaigners have anything to do with it. But again, we constantly change nature, and we continue to do so in ways that are often incredibly detrimental to what you might call the natural world, but also, of course, it's our natural world, it's our environment and our ecology as well as that. Now, I said that we change it through labour. We've had all sorts of different ways of changing the natural world. What we would call hunter-gatherers. They lived by hunting. They lived by gathering food. Depending where they lived and how they lived and when they lived, sometimes hunting was more important. Sometimes food gathering was more important. But their societies, by and large, appears almost always organised their lives in very much more egalitarian ways. Ways that were much more about communal living, less sexism. A much more communal attitude to things like childcare and so on. But about 10,000 years ago, some people who were previously hunter-gatherers like this started to do things that were a little bit different. Around 10,000 years ago, in about four or five different parts of the world, our ancestors started to domesticate and then cultivate plants. Then they cultivated animals afterwards. And that allowed the development of farming to proceed. And once farming became established, and it's a very, very long, drawn-out process, and people should, it allowed humans to organise societies in a fundamentally different way. The surplus that could be produced by agriculture, the fact that groups of individuals could move to grow more food than they needed, meant that for the first time in human history, there were people who could live off the labour of others. They could live off, literally, by eating the food that other people had grown. And that meant all sorts of different things could happen in society. But in some parts of the world, class society, where differentiation between a small group at the top and a larger group in the rest of the world, that fundamentally changed how humans could lead. It also led to all sorts of other things. It led to the rise of the state, it led to the rise of women's oppression on a systematic level. It also meant that war was logical because suddenly there were stocks of grain or food to capture. But I want to concentrate on the farming aspect for a bit. Farming has taken place in many different ways, for many different types of crops and so on and animals, using many different technological implements over millennia. The class struggle is written into nature and often into the landscape. And as new ways of farming developed that were less profitable to landowners and so on, they got rid of these old open field farmings and enclosed the fields. It was a process that took place over centuries, beginning with sort of Tudor times and so on. The old fields were parcelled up and the landscape was changed in the interest of new ways of laying out the land. The systematic, large-scale growing of single monocrops that have all sorts of problems in terms of, again, the environment, but very heavily dependent on machinery, very heavily dependent on pesticides, chemicals and so on, and of course fossil fuels. And of course that's the prevailing image of farming and agriculture today, but actually it's not the reality for most people. There, I think, according to the last United Nations report, something like 400 million peasants who physically farm the land, who do so with no pesticides, no chemicals, nothing but manual labour, and they feed around a billion of the world's population doing that. So a large section of the population of the world doesn't have food that comes from these sort of machines, or indeed very small ploughs or technology. They do it from very old, back-breaking, hard labour, just as their ancestors did. And one of the things about different societies is the way you think about the world and the way you think about people and the natural world changes depending on the type of society that you live in. Marx wrote famously, again, being determines consciousness, that the way you organise your life determines, or the way life is organised around you in most of our cases, determines how you think and approach the world. So one of the things I try to do in the book is to explore this and the particular ecological impact, its ecological relationship, through what happens when people who live in different ways of organising society come into contact with each other. And the classic study of this is the Native American people and the various types of society they lived in, and the European colonists that they met in the aftermath of 1492 when Christopher Columbus arrived in the New World. The Europeans arrived in this unspoiled landscape that was inhabited by backward savages. They went backward and they went, certainly savages, who were really only waiting to be told how that they could run their lives better, and the natural goods and so on were there, they were ready for the Europeans to do with as they will. The sense that actually they saw nature, not in terms of what it could be used for, its use value, but it could be used as a commodity for, its exchange value. And that contrasts very much with these people, who certainly, as I said, when savages across the New World, there were a plethora of different ways of organising society, and even those who were still hunter-gatherers, particularly in the north of the Americas, even there, they lived very complex lives that actually relaterated to the natural world very, very differently to the sort of commodity-obsessed Europeans, the people of New England. There's a chapter in the book on it. They lived in a landscape which was like was described as a patchwork of a landscape. You know, trees in wider landscapes, watered by rivers and so on, filled with animals like bears and deer and so on that could be hunted for skins and so on. But that was a result of millennia, tens of thousands of years of the local Native American tribes burning land to clear spaces, to hunting animals on certain levels to keep population down and so on. It wasn't a natural landscape that the Europeans were finding. It was one that had been shaped deliberately, consciously, in the interests of their way of organising society. And things like the ownership of land meant nothing to these people, because what's the point of owning the land? You're going to use it when you need it, and then you move on to your next part of land for later in the year. It's the natural world in the Americas gets attached to this new way of organising society, this new capitalist, commodity-intensive way of organising society, so it gets changed. And, what happens is the natural world gets connected to a new way of organising society that can see a way, a reason to exploit it, to degrade it, to destroy it, to damage it. So how do we get to a sort of position where one group of people coming from one sort of society could see the natural world simply in terms of its commodities and contrast with, say, earlier ways of organising society where people saw it in terms of its use and certainly would want to keep it in a sustainable way for future generations? And I argue in the book that this is all to do with the changes that take place with the development of capitalism. That's not to say that previous societies didn't see nature always in terms of its use value. That would be nonsense. But the great change that does happen is the way that capitalism arises in the two or three centuries ago in northwest Europe, and then starts to spread rapidly around the globe. And just as with any other transition in society, again, it changes the ideas in particular people's head. In particular, for places like England that went through a revolution to produce capitalism, there's quite a dramatic attitude to that. And in the book, I look at the case of the English Civil War. People like Gerard Winstanley and the Diggers, who had a particular attitude to nature. They were radicals, radical democrats, people who were opposed to the idea that one group at the top of society can impose their will on the vast majority of people. And they believed that the earth was made to be a common treasury for all, that everybody who laboured on the land should have a right to the products of that land. And they did all sorts of radical things. They produced this manifesto in 1649. They tried to occupy various bits of land and to create a sort of democratic way of organising and society and so on. And in the midst of the English Revolution, with all sorts of radical ideas coming to the fore, they were but one small part of those radical generalisations. But the English Revolution, as I said, was a transition period from the old feudal order, marked by kings and queens and lords and ladies and so on, to the new world order that the Marxist historian Nora Carlin once described as a world made safe for capitalism. And the New World Order certainly didn't have any space in it for people like Winstanley and his men and women and followers and so on. So they quickly got rid of that, and they clamped down on any sort of radical approach to the land and so on. I should say there's all sorts of other battles going on in the English Civil War and the English Revolution at this period about evolving land. For instance, people were casting down the old enclosed fields. They were using the political ferment and the chaos to try and regain some of the land that had been taken off them, and stuff like that. But the victory of Oliver Cromwell and the parliamentarians, and the death of the death of King Charles certainly put pay to any attempt to radically reorganise the way that land was used and distributed in England. Oliver Cromwell, in fact, went from being a supporter of anti-enclosure movements at the start of the English Civil War to a big landowner at the end of it who wanted to stop people getting rid of enclosures. But the struggles for land carried on. People like Winstanley obviously harked back to a sort of mythical old order where there were no rulers and so on. But the things he was aspiring to, and control over your land and so on, didn't go away. But what really starts to happen with the development of capitalism post-English Civil War is a process, as I referred to earlier, of enclosure, where people are driven systematically off the land and replaced, driven into the new cities, the new factories, and so on. And those that remain in the countryside tend to be organised as wage labourers and so on. But their struggles continue, and the struggles of the unemployed and the poor labourers in the countryside, who wrote anonymous swing letters to their landlords demanding more money. And this one says, "This is to inform you that you have to undergo, gentlemen, if providing you don't pull down your machines, these are the threshing machines, and raise the poor man's wages, or we will burn down your barns and you in them. This is the last notice." I wish my union negotiated. The struggles, as I say, continue, and continue to the new day, best epitomised by this little poem, which I really love. "The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but leaves the greater villain loose who steals the common from the goose." Again, Karl Marx saw the separation of the mass of the population from the countryside and from the land as one of the preconditions of the development of capitalism. It provided the raw human labour for the factories, it led to the growth of the cities, it carried to the separation between town and country. And now the natural world is seen as part of the labour process, the raw materials of production. And capitalism thus becomes a uniquely unsustainable system, a system that can only see the natural world as something to be exploited, degraded in the interest of profit, as part of the wider production process. And Marx analysed this particularly in his book Capital, through the way he tried to understand how capitalist agriculture was so uniquely unsustainable. He talks about the way it's wasteful and destroys the... He says, "All progress in capitalist agriculture is progress in the art not only of robbing the worker but of robbing the soil, systematically undermining the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the worker." And he talks about the metabolic rift that develops in the society. And, you know, this isn't a real rift. This is the rift that exists because we've been broken, if you like, from the world that around us that we rely on for our society, that we have to labour on, but becomes ever more remote from this. And Marx and Engels discuss this in great detail, particularly looking at the work of soil chemistry and the way that agriculture and capitalism becomes worse and worse over time. But capitalism, again, doesn't simply become a field of struggle between the new industrial proletariat and the capitalist. The struggle takes place in the capitalist world and in the countryside as well, and continues to today. But Marx and Engels analysed all of this, and they said, well, you know, there has to be a better way of doing it. And they understood, of course, that the revolution that they looked to in terms of ending capitalism and replacing it with socialism would in turn do several things. It would heal, to use their phrase, the metabolic rift. It would have to, you know, recreate the potential for a rational agriculture, a rational way of organising production, a more, you didn't use the word, but we can, the new, more sustainable way of organising production. And ending the antithesis between town and country. That's not to say that we're all going to go and live in the countryside, but in the sense that actually there shouldn't be an antagonistic relationship between urban areas and the natural world. Engels famously talked about it in his little book on the housing question. Capitalism, he said, produced an antithesis between town and country, and the abolition of this was a practical demand of both industrial and agricultural production. When one observes here how in London alone a greater quantity of manure than is produced in the whole of Saxony is poured away every day into the sea with an expenditure of enormous sums, and what colossal structures are necessary to do that, to prevent this manure from poisoning the whole of London. And then the utopia of abolishing the distinction between town and country is given a remarkable practical basis. So he's talking about waste from human waste, quite literally human waste, but we can see it today in terms of the way that the madness, the complete irrationality of oil companies searching for more oil, even though burning it will destroy the planet, the irrationality of modern industrialised monocrop agriculture that destroys the land and pours chemicals and stuff onto it. You know, the urgency now, 200 or so years after Marx and Engels were writing, of healing that rift, of solving that thing, of creating production in a more rational way. But I like to think that these struggles that we face today, and this struggle for a socialist way of organising society, is part of all those struggles that have gone before us, and all those people who've lived and fought and died on the land and in the cities. I quoted that poem about the goose, but the whole quote, the first verse that I had there, is a cry of anguish and anger at the enclosures and what they've done to people's families and communities and the rural ecology. But it does continue. The second verse goes, the law demands that we atone when we take things we don't own, but it leaves the lord and ladies fine if you take things that are yours and mine. So true today. The poor and wretched don't escape if they conspire the law to break. This must be so that they endure, those who conspire to make the law. But finally, you see, the poet or the poets finish up with a different way of looking at society. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, and geese will still a common lack till we go and steal it back.
So, there you have it. And following the excellent meeting, we were all treated to a rework of Pete Seeger's Which Side Are You On? Adapted to the UCU dispute at Chesterfield College. So if you weren't there to hear it, well, it's up next.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I tell, of power, the strength of the union, are staying here to dwell. Oh, which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on? My father was a teacher, and I am a teacher's son. We're gonna stay here standing side by side until our battle's won. Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on? Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on? They say in Chesterfield College, no one there can relax. We gotta fight their slash and burning, and our stuff from being sacked. Oh, which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on? Mr. Clay, how can you stand it? Can you tell me how you sleep? There's money for this, there's money for that, but not for your stuff to keep. Oh, which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on? They say there's no alternative, don't listen to their lies. Us folks ain't got a chance unless we organise. Oh, which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Oh, which side are you on now? Oh, which side are you on?
Well done.
Yeah, which side are you on indeed? And speaking of which side are you on, the BBC helped fan a scare story about tuberculosis last month. Its Inside London programme made a big deal of appearing to be scientific and spoke to several TB specialists, but its central claims were false. Tuberculosis is a serious disease that usually affects the lungs. It is spread in the air and if left untreated it can kill. Inside London reported on new strains of the disease that are resistant to many of the antibiotic drugs commonly used to treat it. In reality, TB cases in London, although high at 41 per 100,000 people, are stabilising after 2 years of rising, and Tory austerity is the biggest risk of creating a TB epidemic, because, as reported by Socialist Worker, malnourished people who work long hours and live in poor housing, which they share with many others, are particularly vulnerable. Indeed, a number of factors can cause dormant TB to become the full-blown disease. Probably why, as I remember learning at a Chesterfield branch SWP meeting, the main factor historically in reducing TB in the UK wasn't vaccination, but reduction in pollution and improvements in housing. Now, also reported by Socialist Worker, dormant or subclinical infections can become active as the body's natural defences grow weaker, which is why which is why it's the case that people with the infection can get the disease as they get older. So, attempting to screen immigrants as they enter the UK for the disease won't work because they may still get it as they get older. Now, the whole TB scare is linked with anti-immigration scaremongering. Nigeria and Ghana were mentioned in the BBC News report, despite, in the words of socialist worker, with 108 and 72 cases per 100,000 respectively, the two countries are in the middle of the World Health Organization table. They are much freer of TB than South Africa, with 1,003 cases per 100,000 people, and Sierra Leone with 674. Now, in any case, the Tories' proposals to deny some migrants access to the NHS puts everyone at risk. It also makes it more likely that someone being treated for TB will not complete their course of antibiotics, and that is the key way drug-resistant strains develop. Research shows that people most likely not to finish their treatment are those vilified by the right wing as the cause of the crisis in the NHS, primarily people with drug and alcohol problems. Public healthcare systems can only protect us all from disease by treating the whole population. That's why Tory attempts to stigmatise some of us are a threat to us all. Now, this is not the first time that disease has been linked with immigration. I mean, with Eastern Europe now being the main target of xenophobes, last year there was a scare story that rabies could be reintroduced to the UK in pets imported from Eastern Europe. This was very similar to the paranoia that was ongoing about rabies back in the 70s and 80s when rabies still existed in many Western European countries. And going back further, in the 1990s, there was an Ebola outbreak in Africa and a bubonic plague outbreak in India, which were both sensationalised by the media with a racist undercurrent. In reality, what we have to remember is the biggest threat to our health is not from diseases brought in by immigrants. It's from Tory attacks on our NHS, such as cutbacks and privatisation, and from plans to water down health and safety laws in workplaces, etc. As with so much else, the Tories are trying to make us blame immigrants for crises of their own making, which is why it's all the more important that we must build for the 22nd of March anti-racist scapegoating demo taking place down in London. Anyway, back to the music. We've next up got the sound of the V Faction. This is the track entitled Point One.
This is a 12-point programme to destroy capitalism. Point one.
Organise properly. Get a load of people together. Have a meeting. Agree a strategy. Let's strengthen unity. Remember, this is a war of position. Get the guild together.
So, let's have a meeting.
Talking, I draw up a rotor. If we don't watch, come commercials, then that stuff don't sell. Get the guilt together, baby, alright. When you worry about a little hedge of fun cheating, when you complain about the tossing of your heat, when you see protesters getting a damn good beating, baby, stop retreating.
Let's have a meeting.
Talking out your upper rotor. If we don't watch commercials, then that shit don't sell. Get the guild together, baby. When you're worried about a little headstrong cheating, when you complain about the content of your eating, when you see protesters getting the damn competing, I know who needs to feed him. Babe, let's have a meeting.
This is the Radio Resistance Red Guide, a guide to meetings, entertainment and demos of interest to left-wingers in the Chesterfield area. On Thursday, February the 6th, Chesterfield Socialist Workers Party has its branch meeting on The War on Benefits, How Do We Defend the Welfare State? The Tories and much of the media are waging a war on benefits and the welfare state. The huge cuts are being accompanied by a concerted ideological attack on welfare recipients as scroungers. The speaker is Richard Buckwell from Nottingham TUC. The meeting will be held at 7:30 p.m. at the Assembly Rooms in Chesterfield Market Halls. Then on Thursday, February the 13th, the Chesterfield SWP branch meeting is on Socialist Worker, Why We Need a Revolutionary Newspaper. How do we challenge the ideas of the ruling class and organise our side to fight back? We see our newspaper, Socialist Worker, as a key weapon in the fight. But do we need a newspaper in the online era of the 21st century? Come along to the meeting and join the discussion. The speaker is Gareth Lane from Sheffield Unite Community, also at the Assembly Rooms at Chesterfield Market Halls at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, February the 17th, Chesterfield Unite Against Fascism have a organising meeting to help build for the big demo on March the 22nd. For details of the venue and time, phone 0742 367 2544. That's 0742 367 2544. On Thursday, February the 20th, Chesterfield SWP has its branch meeting on Capitalism and the Roots of LGBT Oppression as part of LGBT History Month. Lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people face systematic oppression despite some significant reforms such as gay marriage. Discrimination still persists. Have LGBT people always been oppressed? Can we build a society where such bigotry is confined to the history books? come along to the meeting and join the discussion. Speaker Laura Miles, leading LGBT activist and trade unionist. Again at the Assembly Rooms, Chesterfield Market Hall at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, March the 8th, it's Born in 84, an event to commemorate the Great Miners' Strike, bringing together music, film, drama, poetry and photography to highlight the strike and its effect on what followed. Held at the Winding Wheel in Chesterfield from 11 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. Last but not least, Saturday, March the 22nd, there's the Stand Up to Racism and Fascism rally and demonstration in central London, marking UN Anti-Racism Day, supported by the TUC, UAF, various trade unions and the Muslim Council of Britain. Assemble at 11 a.m. in central London, details to be confirmed. Transport from Chesterfield by coach, leaving Matlock at 6:30 a.m. and Chesterfield at 7 a.m. Remember, what the working class needs a party which will not sell out for a right-wing agenda to gain middle-class votes. What the working class needs a party which will not kowtow to the bosses and the ruling class. What the working class needs a party which is run by and for the working class. The Socialist Workers' Party is that party.
Precisely soldering sugar, the heat in the beat. We keep it hotter than fire, straight spitting the heat. So you know for a fact that this clique is elite. And we're still f***ing you to the pigs in the street. Cause this city that we're living in is f***ing weak. Full of mans for no reason, just bringing the beef. And the government is crooked and ragged. Good job, I'm loving this rapping. So we just say and smash it. But sometimes I don't know how my brain copes. I sit and chain smoke, stay stoned as I let the rage grow. Hit the stage show and make sure I'm dropping the rap right. And keep this shit hotter than the rocks in a crack pipe. My mind stays high like the stars in the sky. And my soul stays trapped in the dark of the night. And my mind stays sharper than knives. My flows hit hard like nails hammered straight through the palm of the Christ.
There's nothing great about Britain, that's why we stay spitting. And that's the life that we're living. You better nod your head to the kicks and the snare. There ain't nothing great about Britain, that's why we stay spitting.
The rottenish.
And that's the life that we're living. You better nod your head to the kicks and the snare. And say, oof, Great Britain, with your fists in the air.
The same kids I used to idolise, I hate now. They kept the same values from the playground. Fighting over until the day it kills them. They call each other big men, so why'd you act like children? See me, I stick to what I know best, making music. I find it therapeutic, always looking out for see hip-hop right now, like the heavyweight division. Lack of talent, title there for the lifting. It's not a lack of skill, just a lack of it in depth. People bite each other's arms, are scared to make something fresh. So you knock some together, you thought it sounded clever. Reality, it's rubbish, full of schoolboy errors. Music off, I watch the news to get me downhearted. Two women die a week at the hands of their partners. The bank used to love me, now I'm skint, they give me charges. They can suck the richest on the poorer man regardless. Race is turning on their own, it leaves them torn. When they ain't accepted here, or where mama was born. So they travel on a plane to what's supposed to be the motherland. Because they've lived in Britain, then they're no longer a brother man. So jump into their shoes for two, here's the onus. They get back home to get abused again and feel homeless. So jump into their shoes for two, cause here's the onus. They get back home to get abused again and feel
the
homeless.
There ain't nothing great about Britain, that's why we stay spitting. And that's the life that we're living. You better nod your head to the kicks and the snare. There ain't nothing great about Britain, that's why we stay spitting.
The rottenish.
And that's the life that we're living. You better nod your head to the kicks and the snare. And say, oof, Great Britain, with your fists in the air.
Years run strong, number ones come along. Heads follow on, jogging on, going off on one. Dedicated,
weed medicated. Slated rappers through mass facts I stated. Underestimated, underrated, now greatest. Dominating mics on a full-time basis. Status okay, but do I still wanna make it? I just wanna live on good monthly wages. My life's like a it's controlled by a matrix. I hate this Great Britain that tax created. I wish I could go back to olden ages. All you see these days is life being wasted. Eights all over, from Scotland to Dover. Thousands are thinking we are stoner personas. So hold your fists up, skin your spliffs up. If you're Britain, I've written you this. Off Britain.
Yeah, sound of Constant Creation, track entitled A CUK Britain. Now, Mondigon, there was the Holocaust Memorial Day event in Chesterfield at the Donuts Community Arts Centre, which included poetry, the play about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and some Jewish story weaving. Now, a number of poems were read, including this one coming up, which is entitled The Kinder Transport.
Okay, I'm reading a piece called The Kinder Transport by Andrew Hamm. 17th of March, I'm scared. I've been on this train for 2 hours now, and I don't know where I'm going. It all started this morning. A strange person with a strange accent came to my house and told me we had to leave. So me and my little brother went to the station and got on a train. We don't know where we're going. We're so very frightened about what might happen to us. We faced discrimination for oh so long. The people who are taking us say they're here to help us. But we don't know. They could actually be here to hurt us. We just don't know. 18th of March. This morning, the train arrived at a place called The Hook of Holland. No sooner had the train arrived than we were herded off the train and into the pouring rain. In the rush to get out of the house, I had forgotten to pack my raincoat, and so it was that I became absolutely soggy in the short walk to the ship that, I was now told, would be taking me to a place I barely heard of called England. All I know about England is that it's located west of Germany, across the North Sea, and that the capital is called London. Other than that, I still have no idea where I'm going or what it will be like. The ship is big. The view of the Hook of Holland is beautiful. However, the view in the other direction, towards the sea, is magnificent. I've never seen the sea before. I always thought the sea was just blue land, as it looks in my school's atlas. It turns out that it's actually made of water. I don't know how the ship stays afloat. Considering how heavy it must be, I guess it must have wheels at the bottom, just like the bathtub at home has a bottom. There's a seating area on the top floor where most of the children are sitting. I guess there's a few hundred of us altogether, all going across the sea to England. Standing around these seats are some sailors wearing white. The sailors seem nice, so maybe I am being rescued from the Nazis rather than being kidnapped as I originally thought. Downstairs is another seating area, this one indoors. The seating area has a cafe attached, but unlike the cafes in Dresden, this one actually welcomes Jews. I had a hot chocolate which tasted nice. Overall, I'm enjoying my time on the ship, and I now look forward to what surprises might meet me in that place called England. I'm also going to read two very short poems by Nina Moss. The light at the end of the tunnel. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's something that everyone knows. There's a light at the end of the shadows. A tiny spark will soon show. There's a light that defeats all the darkness. Look at it shine as it grows. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. It sets us free. And Hope by the same person. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, your shining hope has travelled far. I ask for just one wish tonight, keep us safe to the morning light.
Yeah, now I mentioned the play Voices, which was about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of 1944, and I'm going to play you a excerpt from the play, so you've idea of sort of how good it was and how hard-hitting it was.
This is the BBC from London. Allied powers continue to report major features since last year's shock attack on Pearl Harbor.
and America's entry into the war. Things have finally begun to turn. The Allies are hooting German advances around the world. Hitler's great offensive into Russia appears to be grinding to an unscheduled halt. Many losses are reported in the battle for Stalingrad. In Central Europe, Reich Protector Reinhard Heydrich, the man with an iron heart, responsible for thousands of deaths, has been assassinated by the Czech resistance.
Yes, this part of the play was involved a argument between a member of the resistance and the leader or so-called leader of the ghetto, who was a Jewish bloke who ended up being responsible for which Jews were to be sent out to the gas chambers to be executed. Very powerful, very sort of hard-hitting, but positive message that there is still hope of resistance, even in the most desperate of circumstances. Of course, there were the dancing and the props and what have you. It's a shame that if you didn't see it, it's a shame that you weren't actually there, because it's not really possible to do it justice on radio. Anyway, back to the music next. On the lines of anti-fascism, here's the sound of the Manic Street Preachers. Almost needs no introduction. If you tolerate this, your children will be next.
Oh,
Some of the managed to eat preachers. If you tolerate this, your children will be next. Well, that's near enough all we've got time for this week. So over to you. If you'd like to contact Radio Resistance, whether to request or dedicate a song, whether you'd like to give us some information on what's happening, whether you'd like to comment on the broadcast, well, you can contact us by email at radioresistancechesterfield@yahoo.co.uk. That's radioresistancechesterfield@yahoo.co.uk. www.thebbc.co.uk, or you can phone or text us on 0793 479 3041. That's 0793 479 3041. Or search for Radio Resistance Chesterfield within Facebook, like the page, and then send us a message or leave a note on the wall. But like I say, that's about all we've got time for this week. So I'm going to sign off with a track that there's currently a campaign to get to number one in the protest against UKRAP's homophobic, hydrophobia about gay people or gay marriage allegedly causing storms and floods. It's the Sound of the Weather Girls, track entitled It's Raining Men. Catch you next week.
Hi, we're your weather girls.
Uh-huh.
And have we got